very well.
My name is Ray O'Keefe, and I'm an alcoholic. I am a member of the world-famous Mamaroneck Group, which is located at Mamaroneck, New York. You've all heard of that group, I'm sure. I bring you the warm and the fraternal greetings of the Mamaroneck Group. I am authorized by our steering committee to extend to you their best wishes for a good convention. The vote of our committee was 11-7. I'm happy to be back in California. I've met some of my old AA pals here that I've met many times before, and of course I've met some new friends in AA when I'm here. I've even met a great number of the Al-Anon ladies who are with us tonight, and I was surprised that there were so many Al-Anon ladies here. I thought that they would be attending a rather super and important meeting of Al-Anon, which is being held in Orange in the mother church of all Al-Anon, the Church of Our Lady of Perpetual Revenge. Let me tell you about my drinking. I don't want you to miss any of this. Thrill a minute. I grew up in one of the neighborhoods in New York City, and my neighborhood was rough, and it was tough, and it was Irish. Now, this would come as a surprise to you here in San Diego, but they drank in that neighborhood. You would actually see people on the street under the influence of alcohol. Oh, yes. Difficult to believe, but true. If you looked at where I lived, you'd see a little drinking. My mother, the widow O'Keefe, was known to take a drink from time to time. And when the pressure got on, Kitty would go for the light wines and the spirits, and something would fly, usually one of the children. My older brother, Billy, on the other hand, was a bad drunk, and in an Irish neighborhood, Billy stood out as a drunk. And so when I showed up at the local joint and ordered up whatever it was they were serving 14-year-olds that afternoon, no one paid any attention to me. It was just another O'Keefe coming through the system. I truly don't recall what it was they gave me. I suspect it was a beer. That was the neighborhood drink. But whatever it was, I liked it. I liked everything about it. I liked the way it looked. And I liked the way it smelled. And I liked the way it tasted. And I liked what it did for my head. And I liked the noise and the smoke and the confusion. And I liked the fist fights and the Irish music. I liked the bullshit. That's what I really liked. And for the next 20 years, I went for it. I was going through the parochial school system, in a manner of speaking, and I got into all of the difficulties and troubles that you might imagine a young man would get into trying to go through that system drunk. I was thrown out of high school a number of times. I held the neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record previously established by my brother Billy. When high school was finished with me because someone made a mistake in a small school in New England, I got a chance to leave the neighborhood, and I went north to college, and my drinking changed, and I found out later every time I changed my environment, my drinking changed. When I went north, there were no bars in that state. It was just restaurants. And they sat around tables. and they drank beer out of a bottle. And they wore white shoes in the wintertime. And being a man of no particular moral fiber, I got a pair of white shoes. I learned some of those songs. I got very collegiate. World War II was just about over, and it was a safe bet. And one day I got a haircut and joined the Navy. And I ended up on a minesweeper in San Francisco. I don't like to be indelicate at a large gathering such as this, but I have to tell you, I had a lot of trouble with my kidneys when I drank. And in the Navy, we slept three to a tier, and the new man slept on top. Don't get ahead of me now. It's very difficult there. I came back from my first liberty in San Francisco with all the beer in me I could buy, and I went to sleep, and I had one of these attacks. And I got to meet the fellow that slept below me that night. I'm sure he thought he'd be wet sometime in his naval career, but it hadn't occurred to him it would happen while he was sleeping. I was immediately transferred to a lower bunk. The rest of my naval career was undistinguished. I pause only to mention my arrest and 2 days in the San Diego jail in 1945 for a crime about which I was unjustly accused. I never did hit that cop. I hit the bartender, but I did not hit the cop. And 2 days later, they sent me back out into the harbor to the ship, and the rest of the Navy was just the Navy. And when it was over, I went back to the neighborhood. And everything was under control in the neighborhood. The widow was out in the weeds somewhere. My brother Billy was over the hill and absent without leave from the New York City Police Department. He had invited a citizen off a five-story roof, and the citizen bounced and lived to identify the Irish cop. Billy went west. He went into a more peaceful line of work. He joined the Marines and came here to Camp Pendleton. The 5220 Club was available for heroes. We got $20 a week for 52 weeks. I joined the 5220 Club. I gravitated to the local joint. I took up the game of shuffleboard. And I was planning a life of petty crime with some of my boyhood companions when I had one of those clear thoughts that come from time to time. I recall that I'd been to college. So I got on a bus and I went back up there. And I arrived in the middle of a blizzard. And I walked into this place and there they were, sitting around the table. Drinking beer out of a bottle, singing no songs, wearing no shoes. So I got another pair of shoes, and by now a grateful government was sending me a check every month, so I was moderately solvent and therefore moderately drunk all the time. And one day I was staggering around the campus in my usual condition when I saw a list on a bulletin board of people who were qualified to graduate. And my name was on the list. And that was extremely good news. I thought I had another year to go. So I notified the widow of this great event. And she came north, and that was a rather tender sight. The widow and her youngest child staggering around under the elm. About 10 years later, I served as a trustee of that college, and I'd go to meetings. They were still talking about my mother. It isn't often in the state of Vermont where they see a little old lady get off a train drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning. I came back home after school and back to the neighborhood, and the question then was what to do. My uncle, who ran the family, had voted unanimously that I become a member of the New York City Police Department, because that's what my father had done, and that's what my brother had done, and that's what all my uncles and my cousins were doing, except for the two morons that worked for the telephone company. But I told them I wasn't going to do that. I had my own plans, and I was going to do what I wanted to do. That's part of being alcoholic. I wanted to do what I wanted to do. And I told them I had received a scholarship to law school, and I'd be unemployed for the next several years. And that was received with mixed emotions. Yeah. But that's what happened. I went to law school, and again, my environment changed. And I didn't know anything about law school before I went. I didn't know anything about lawyers. I'd never met one. We didn't have any lawyers in my neighborhood. We had cops and we had priests. We really didn't need any lawyers. I hate to be disloyal to the profession that's done so well for me, but I must tell you that when I got to law school, I found I was in the company of the greatest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled. They all had on a blue suit and they wore eyeglasses. So as soon as I got into uniform and I got a pair of glasses I don't think I needed, I looked around for a companion, someone to drink with. My mother always told me, play with nice boys your own age. Well, nobody drank in that crowd. They were all studying. They were all students. They were all grinding it out. So I became the biggest grind they ever had in that place. And I didn't drink at all in my first year and very rarely in the next 2 years. With the result that when I came out of school, I had done well and I was taken into a large, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, Wall Street law firm. They hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. It wasn't a total loss. However, I learned to say, oh, really, instead of no shit. You're bad, you're bad. I don't know about you people. My superiors there were very wise, and they determined that I ought to be trained as a trial lawyer, and so I was sent right away up to the New York City courthouse to learn my trade. And I wasn't in the courthouse very long before I discovered that all the wise guys were across the street in a saloon. So I moved my office into a saloon, and I got a little priority on the phone and some credit, and I learned to drink in a different way, more civilized, more genteel fashion. Very few members of the profession were knocking down shots and beers where anybody could see them. I learned to drink scotch in a tall glass with water and ice, and you sip on that. It takes a little while, but it gets the job done. I was introduced to all of the mysteries and all of the rituals of the very, very dry martini. And to this night and to this minute, my love, my admiration, and my affection for the very, very dry martini is surely the greatest taste of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal to those things, and they almost destroyed me. Well, after about a year of this civilizing influence, it was necessary in my natural development that I be married. And I had located a lady, or she had located me. I'm not sure how those things work. Ms. O'Keefe, my wife, my current wife. I always call her my current wife. I find it keeps her on her toes. Ms. O'Keefe and I were married right before the war. I'm not talking about World War III or World War IV. I'm talking about the war between me and Mrs. O'Keefe. Which has continued unabated for 30 years. Ms. O'Keefe, from a totally different background than mine, she was raised in Westchester County in a large home with devoted parents and servants and a fence and a dog. In a word, her family had a buck. I drank a lot in those days, but I knew what was going on. I will not burden you with the details of my wedding day, but I assure you that one of the O'Keefes from the Bronx hit the Westchester Country Club. They set a few records. There was only one fight. It was not a particularly good fight. My Uncle Bernie hit a waiter. After that, we settled down and set up housekeeping, and Ms. O'Keefe then began to produce children in a rather boring and monotonous fashion, and with the regularity that is known only to the devout Roman Catholic. After about the second of these marvelous events, I received a phone call from the law school I had attended, and I was invited to come see the dean, and I went to see the dean, and he appointed me to the faculty, and I became Professor O'Keefe, and I responded to that appointment with great alacrity, and there I was, the boy professor, and I became very concerned about that appointment because I really wasn't sure what there was in my background to justify it, and I knew that I drank a great deal, so I resolved that I would not drink so much. It's a very simple proposition. If you drink too much, you should drink less, and I figured that one out, and I began to drink less. Unfortunately, I was not able to drink less. It was a very unsuccessful experiment, but as things worked out, after a couple years or so, It turned out that I was a good teacher, so there was really no reason to control my drinking anymore once I found out that I could do this stuff. And so I went back out to drink the way I like to drink. And I only knew the one way to drink. My father died when I was 2. I had an older brother, Billy, who was 4 years older than I was, and Billy was real good looking, about 6'3" and a big Marine. And I did everything just like Billy. And he taught me all the good stuff, including how to drink. And I drank just like Billy. I drank until I fell down, or the place went on fire, or the cops arrived, or something would interfere with the drinking. I would see people leaving, and I would wonder where they were going. And I then started out to drink the way I wanted to drink, and I did this, and I did it a lot and often and every day. And I roamed around the city of New York, and I did all of the things that lawyers who drink and are on the make do when they roam around the city of New York. And I served on an awful lot of governmental commissions, and I had a lot of appointments by the governor and by the mayor. And I even ran for office one time and lost. And in this period of time, and all of those appointments, by the way, were just because I was affiliated with a very prestigious law faculty in New York City. And during this time, Mrs. O'Keefe and I bought a large, semi-authentic colonial home in a village called Larchmont, New York, a village which abounds in semi-authentic colonial homes. And we had it up to 5 or 6 children and a number of motor vehicles and memberships in the local clubs. In a word, all of the trappings of the middle class were mine. And if you asked me in those days how I was doing, I would have told you I was doing very well. In fact, I would have told you that whether you asked me or not. That was one of my favorite themes. Truth of the matter was, at this time, at age 34, I had turned into a daily drunk. And my day would have killed a lesser man. I used to come to in the morning in that wet sack because the problem with the kidneys had continued, unabated all those years. And I would struggle out of that wet bed and I'd begin my morning calisthenics. My calisthenics were performed kneeling on the floor of a bathroom with my head in a bowl. And I would have all the water running, the water in the shower and the water in the tub and the water in the sink, because I did not want Ms. O'Keefe and all those little O'Keefe to know that Professor O'Keefe was dying. I would come downstairs in my sincere blue suit, carrying over my shoulder, much like Santa Claus, a sack of wet laundry, because Ms. O'Keefe had told me that the diaper service was for the children. And she did not think that a lady of her extreme breeding ought to do the wash of a 34-year-old bedwetter. You can imagine a man of my stature in the community starting off each morning with a load of wash. But once I got my wash out of the way, help was at hand. I used to keep a quart of vodka in the refrigerator. My children call that daddy's juice. And I would take a few bangs on daddy's juice. And then the question was, would I throw up in front of all these people? I knew if I lit up a cigarette, I was finished. Sooner or later, I'd go into New York and I'd get to Grand Central on the train. And I don't know how much you know about New York, but Grand Central is really not a railroad terminal. It is a collection of saloons that are connected by tunnels. And I would roam around the tunnels and pop up like a mole here or there and do a repair job. And then I'd head for the law school. And as soon as I got to that imposing institution, my first thought was, how do I get out of here? And I'd get out and I'd tear across town and I'd steal 20 bucks from a law firm's petty cash to finance my drinking for that day. And then I'd be out with my $20 and into a taxi, and I would go to where I really belonged, my first parish, the bar down by the courthouse. And by this time, the other lawyers were treating me like a playmate or a mascot or something. And I'd run in and throw up my dough, and I'd buy a drink, and they'd buy a drink, and the bartender would buy a drink. And maybe we'd talk a little business, and maybe we wouldn't, and maybe we'd settle something, and maybe we wouldn't. It really wasn't important. I would have a drink about every 20 minutes, and I had to figure it out in some peculiar alcoholic fashion that I was particularly brilliant at 2 o'clock. So I'd schedule all my classes for then, and I'd zoom up to the school and inflict myself on those poor, unwilling sophisticates who had come to study at my feet. And I would shortchange the kids terribly, and I'd run out and jump into a cab, and I'd go over to Grand Central to commute. Now, even though I grew up in the city, I understood the theory of commuting. Commuters are entitled to a drink before they get on the train. So I'd have 10 or 12. And I would take a train going north. It didn't have to go to Larchmont. North was good enough for me. I got to see a great deal more of Bridgeport, Connecticut than any civilized man would have to. Sooner or later, I'd arrive home and I'd bounce off a few walls and take what was left of daddy's juice out of the refrigerator and fill up an old jelly glass some kid had left laying around and inquire if anybody wanted a martini. But I was the only one that drank in that house in those days, and I'd have a few pops, and then I would eat or not eat, depending on my mood. Evenings, I would spend in civic endeavor. Lawyers are very fond of civic endeavor. Civic endeavor by me was cracking up the car or puking on some hostess's sofa, or playing a little grab-ass with the ladies of Larchmont, and a sorrier-looking crop you have never seen. Most nights, I would just stay home and vegetate, and I would watch television with one eye like this, trying to get those sets to come together. I'd sit and I'd drink, and I'd watch television with one eye. And I'd go through the programming and through the news and into the late show and on into the morning. And finally, my big moment would come. When they played the Star Spangled Banner. And the Marines would go up Mount Suribachi. And the destroyers would cut through the water. And those planes would be flying by. And they'd be playing that song. And I would cry. I would weep and sob and cry. And I'd go upstairs and wet the bed, and that was it. I was a great leaker. I leaked from all ends. Well, as anybody who's ever been married can tell you, while all of this was going on, Mrs. O'Keefe was not entirely silent. From time to time, she would have the temerity to suggest that there was something radically wrong with the way I drank. But I'd pay no attention to her. First of all, she is my wife. What can she know? Secondly, she is not an attorney. And I would tell her that. And then we would have the discussion. And I would explain to her what I then termed the O'Keefe theory of the relativity of drinking, which is to say that some people drink more than other people. And I would explain to her on a relative scale, I was a very moderate drinker. And as a matter of fact, I would say, I don't drink as much as my mother. And she would say, nobody drinks as much as your mother. And then I would have to leave for 3 or 4 days because she had insulted my mother. And it should come, it was no surprise when she suddenly decided that she was going crazy. And so she betook herself to her physician, who, as you might imagine, is an obstetrician. And he could find nothing the matter with her until she explained to him that she lived with a drunk. And he sent her home to me with a message. And the message that she brought me was that her doctor, the obstetrician, had diagnosed her husband, the professor, as an alcoholic. Oh, I was so upset to hear that. I rose to defend myself, as was my custom, and I began a jury summation. The first point that I made, I thought, was a rather good one. I took a very dim view of a physician who would diagnose a patient without having seen him. I was against that shabby medical practice, all too common in our country today. I then launched myself into high gear, and I asked Mrs. O'Keefe a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. Huh?
Just some audience.
And then it happened. I don't know how this happened. It just happened. I cannot explain to you what happened. I can explain many, many other things to you, and I probably will in the second or third hour of this terrific talk that I'm giving. But in the middle of all of this yelling and screaming and confusion, I suddenly stopped, and I admitted to Mrs. O'Keefe, for the first time I had ever admitted to anybody, that there was at least the possibility that I drank too much sometimes. This was a very serious tactical error. Because 3 days later, I found myself a prisoner in a mental institution in Stamford, Connecticut. And I was only there a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. They had sandbagged the old professor. And I mentioned this to a man in a white coat who was passing by. In addition to all of these outrageous circumstances in which I, an innocent person, found myself, it also happened to be the occasion of my 35th birthday. And I mentioned this to a man in a white coat who was passing through, and I very carefully explained to that cretin that on that very day I had attained age 35, and therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, I was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said there were two other presidents in residence. He made me promise not to cause them any additional security problems. And then he went away and he left me. And so for the next week or so, I did all of those warm, wonderful, happy, and interesting things that alcoholics do when they withdraw from alcohol. I shook, I sweat, I did everything else terrific that you can think about. And I finally came up for air, and I was then visited by the staff of the hospital, and they, of course, were psychiatrists. This was a very fancy rattle box, as befitted a man of my stature. And I gave three different stories to three different doctors. And they immediately sent for Mrs. O'Keefe. And I was brought into a very large room, and Mrs. O'Keefe was in the middle of it, hysterical. And she told me that I was in grave danger of being expelled from a mental institution. On the grounds of non-cooperation. And I said, let's go. But she was determined that I would stay, and she was determined that I would become sober, so took the last dime her father ever made. And so I went back to where I was staying. I agreed to stay, and I went back. I was engaged then in a form of therapy which had not yet been recognized in the medical field. It was the game of Monopoly. I was playing Monopoly around the clock with three other guys who were there. They weren't alcoholics. They were just there. And one of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. And if you know anything of the game of Monopoly and some nut thinks you're his real estate broker, you can do very, very well. I had the boardwalk, I had a number of hotels, and I was very happy with the Monopoly therapy. And I was into about the fourth day of the Monopoly marathon when they told me I had another visitor, and I didn't know what that would be, so I went into my large executive-type padded cell to wait, and through the door of that room came this very imposing-looking man, and he announced that he was from the Darien, Connecticut group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that the hospital, having given up on me, had asked him if he could do anything and tell me about our program. And I immediately responded to type, and I almost had him by the throat, and I was yelling at him, "Alcoholics, now what are you out of your mind?" And I started. And he told me to shut up. That's tacky. I immediately forgave him because I knew that he just had not been properly briefed, and they had neglected to tell him who I was. So I continued to speak. He told me to sit down and to shut up and to listen to him. Well, he was an imposing-looking man, and I was not a well person. And so for the first time in 35 years, I sat, and he began to explain to me, as I have been trying to indicate to you, and as we are instructed in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, what it was like. He told me what his drinking was like. He told me how he had come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told me what his life had been since. And he asked me if I would like to go with him to meetings. And I said, "You mean outside to meetings, sir?" He said, "Outside." I said, "I'll go." And besides that, he gave me matches. And no one else had allowed me to have any matches. And so that's how it began with me. And that was in January of 1963. And he talked me all around the roads of Connecticut. And we went to all of these meetings. And he made arrangements for me to go locally. And I came home and I began to attend locally. And I don't recall so much of all of that. I was too new and too nervous and too afraid and too everything. And the hospital had turned me loose with a large jar of those pills that they insist on giving alcoholics. And I was walking around, my head buzzed a lot. But I know myself fairly well. I figured I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You would recognize me as a superior person. You would elect me your president. I was always president if I joined something. I would serve a term as your president. You would retire me with honor, and that would be that, onward and upward. Well, it probably doesn't come as any surprise to you, but it was a terrible shock to me to find out that about 10 months later, I was very, very drunk. And I lasted 10 months, and then I was drunk again. And this time, of course, I was drunk with a great difference, because I had turned away from the great power that is in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was to stay drunk for a period of time. And I won't take you through it, because it takes too long, and it makes the hair on the back of my neck start to go up when I think about it. But just let me indicate to you that it was, without question, the worst period of my life. It was murder. It was pure and simple murder. I never knew when I would be drinking or when I would not be drinking. I never knew when I would begin to drink, and I certainly never knew where I would be or when I would stop drinking. I would drink a week, and then I wouldn't drink a month. I would drink a month, and then I wouldn't drink a week. I would drink and come to these meetings. Or I would come to these meetings, and then I would drink. I just never knew what was going to happen next. Things began to happen to me in this period of time that had never happened to me before. And I don't speak to you now of things that happened to me in this period of time, which I no longer consider to be significant. I do not speak to you now of the fact that I was dismissed from the faculty and fired as a tenured professor of law And that all of the appointments and all of the honors and all of the prestige and all of the dollars that went with that position were taken from me in a period of about 15 minutes. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was in serious, and I mean very serious, personal, professional, and financial difficulties. I do not even speak to you of the fact that I had lost the affection of all those who were around me. All of this happened to me in this period of time, but this is not what I am speaking to you about. What I now appreciate was happening to me at this time, and what I now speak to you about is that I think there was in my case, and perhaps in yours, a terrible, terrible wasting of my spirit. My spirit, that thing that separates me from my cat and separates me even from each of you. That spirit which gives to this particular form whatever individuality or personality or character that it might have. And this was a spirit which once burned in me so bright. And it was extinguished, and I knew it, and there was nothing that I could do about it. That self-knowledge, the book tells us, will never help us. I knew it, but there was nothing I could do about it. I'd been here, and this didn't work for me. And by this time, I've been everywhere else. I've been through the drying out joints in the hospitals and the sanitariums and the doctors and the nurses. And I've been through the jobs and the money and the friends and the politicians, and I've been up and down every avenue there was, and the result was always the same. I was drunk. And it wasn't as though I didn't know about drinking. I knew about drinking. I had the knowledge about drinking. I had a memory. I remembered the neighborhood. I knew about my family. I had been to the funeral. I knew what happened to people who drank as I did, but I continued to drink. And I did not think, I truly did not think that it would ever end. But my time came one day. One day, my time came. I don't know any more about this than you do. But it seems to me that there is a time for all of us. And it seems to me that there is a time for each of us. I say to you that there is a line somewhere beyond which we are simply not permitted to sink. And I say to you that there is a point somewhere below which we simply are not permitted to go. And I say to you also that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. I don't know where this line is for you. I only know what happened to me. And this is a personal and an individual thing. And it is different in each case. And for some, it may be death. And that's the way it was for my brother Billy. The man called me one night from the Veterans Hospital in Minneapolis, and he told me that my brother had died of alcoholism in that hospital where they had taken him from the Skid Row of Minneapolis. And so my brother and my hero died the way alcoholics do, without family and without friends. And he was a long, long way from our neighborhood. But my brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. And that's how he stopped. And for other people, it can be something very trivial. But the line is there somewhere. And I think we all come to it in our own time and in our own way. But come to it we must. And I arrived at a day that really wasn't much different from many, many other days. I was 2 or 3 days away from a drink. I was in this place where I worked. I was nervous. I was thirsty. I thought I'd just go downstairs and have a few pops. I knew I'd feel better. But instead of doing that, I was given the great grace to be able to call a longtime friend of mine who was a longtime member of this fellowship. And his name is John, and he is my sponsor. And I called John, and I told him what was going on, and he said he'd be right over, and he was. And John walked into that room, and he looked so good, and I felt so bad. And I asked him what I would have to do to be as successful as he was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And John gave me that look that he has, and he said, "Don't drink. Go to meetings. You'll be all right." Well, I didn't want him to tell me that. And I told him I didn't want him to tell me that. I told him it was much too simplistic for someone of my background. And I told him he really didn't understand the problem. I said, "You see, the real problem is really, the real problem here is this place where I work." Said, "A lawyer of my talent should not be in a place like this." He said, "Well, yeah, don't drink. You go to meetings. I'll be all right." I said, "John, it's worse at home. You know, I can't even go up there anymore. She's got the court order and she's out of her mind." Yeah, he said, "Well, don't drink and you go to meetings. That'll be all right." I said, "John, I'm being sued by Bankers Trust." "Yeah," he said, "I read about that." "Yeah, well, don't drink and you go to meetings." I sensed that there was no dialogue there. And so did John, because he said, "Well, Raymond, you're not doing very much. Let's go." And he took me out of there, and he made a phone call or two, and he put me on a train up to Larchmont, which is about a 40-minute ride. And halfway up, I reconsidered. You understand. I must have panicked. You know, why did I call him? Don't drink, right? Don't drink my ass. Wait till this train stops. And that was my attitude, and I got off the train at Larchmont, and standing on the platform of the Larchmont station was my mailman, a guy named Al, who was then chairman of the world-famous Mamaroneck Group. And Al said, "Get in the car." And I said, "Get out of here, Al. I don't hang around with mailmen." Said, "Some guy named John called me about you. Get in a car." A man of my position can't really have a fist fight with a mailman, or anybody else for that matter. So I got in Al's car. I said, "Al, I got a lot of problems, Al." "Yeah," he said, "well, don't drink. You go to meetings." So if any of you are foolish enough to ask my advice because I'm from out of town, that's my advice. You don't drink, go to meetings, you'll be all right. Al and I took a ride, and he came by that night, and he took me up to the world's greatest AA group, and I didn't drink that day, and I haven't had a drink since. And sometimes it seems a long time, but really not. But first I had that day. And I had that day because two members of our fellowship were so filled with the gratitude of this fellowship that they took what God sent that day. A drunken, dishonest, arrogant man. And because they were so grateful for what they had received, they gave me a day. And because they gave me that day, all the rest of the days have seemed to follow. And I was told to go to meetings every day, and I went to meetings every day, and I still go to meetings every day. I go every day. And I would see John in the daytime, and I'd see Al in the nighttime, and I'd get my instructions. And after a few months or so, one day John took me, and he said, "You know, Raymond, you're not such a bad fellow. You're not drinking, you're going to meetings, you hang around pretty good." He said, "It's about time you learned something about the program." And he gave me the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, "Here, read this book." And I said, because I am the way I am, I said, "What, are you kidding me? Read this book. Rarely have we seen anyone fail who has thoroughly..." He gave me that look. You know that look that they give you? The look that long-time members of AA reserve for smart-ass people. And he said, "Read it again." And I said, "Yes, John." It seemed that every discussion I had with that man, the end of it was when I said, "Yes, John." And I began to read again the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I was amazed. I had no understanding or appreciation that that book had been written some 5 years after the meeting of Bill and Bob in Akron. I did not understand or appreciate that that book was nothing more or less than a chronicle of the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not understand that the steps that are contained in the fifth chapter of that book, which have been read for us this evening, were steps that were literally taken by these men and these women as they became sober. I thought when first I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that if I told you my name was Ray O'Keefe and that I was an alcoholic, I was doing something about the first step of this program. Of course, that's my name, and I'm an alcoholic. But the men and women who founded our program did a great deal more than simply identify themselves as alcoholics. They admitted that they were powerless over alcohol, that their lives had become unmanageable. And their lives had become unmanageable because they were powerless over alcohol. It was all one thing with them. They were saying the same thing twice. They were powerless. They were without power. It says in that book that the dilemma of the alcoholic is his lack of power. He has no power. He is powerless. But they didn't drink. And time began to pass for them. And time has passed for the great convention at San Diego. And time has passed for me. And if you come here new, time will pass for you. And time has a wonderful way of passing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It passes one day at a time. And somewhere after this succession of days, these men and these women came to believe that there was a power greater than their own. And they believed that this power could restore them to sanity. And so firm and so true and so real was that belief that they were able to make a decision to turn over their will and their lives to the care of this power that they had come to believe in, this God, as they each understood him. And they were very, very bright, because at a time in the history of this country when no one else had this notion, they conceived alcoholism to be a disease. They conceived it to be a disease that was physical and mental and spiritual, a disease of the body and of the mind and of the spirit. And then when they found, when they stopped drinking, that their bodies responded quickly, and when they came to believe that there was a power that could restore them to sanity, they began a mental recovery. It was slower than the physical recovery, but it was perceptible. They could notice it. And when they made that decision, that was the key that opened the door. When they made that decision, when they were able to offer themselves to God to do with as he would, when they asked to be relieved of the bondage of self, when they surrendered and when they let go and they let God, they not only began a spiritual recovery, but they laid down the basis for a spiritual way of life to which you and I are heir. They left that to us. And they were very smart, too, because they knew that it wasn't enough to stop drinking and start praying. A lot of people have tried that. It doesn't work. They knew that if they were to be successful, somehow they would have to change. And in order to effect this change in themselves, they began a searching and a fearless moral inventory of themselves. They could be searching because by now they were relatively clear. They could be fearless because they had made a decision to turn over their lives to the care of this God that, as they each understood him. Imagine an alcoholic without fear. That's impossible. It embarrasses me to tell you that the ruling emotion of my life when I drank was fear. For all of those years, the great man and the boy professor was afraid most of the time. But this program helps with that. And so great was the love and the affection of these people, one for the other, that they were able to take that inventory and to admit it to themselves and to this God that they had come to believe in. And then they brought it and they shared it with someone else. And it was a great relief for me to be able to take this thing to my sponsor. And it was he who told me the exact nature of my wrongs. I wasn't really capable of making that kind of a judgment. I knew what I had done. He told me what the exact nature of the wrongs were. And then they developed an attitude which was difficult for me. They became entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character. And with compelling logic, they went to that great power that they had come to believe in, and they humbly asked him to take these shortcomings and defects from them. And it began to work for them. And it's worked for millions of people ever since. And whatever is said or thought or even written about our great fellowship, the one thing upon which there must be perfect unanimity is that it works. It really works. And one only has to come and stand at where I stand in San Diego on this Saturday night and look out at you. And I know, if I ever needed to know more, it really works. And they were smart enough to know, too, that they had not come here alone. They knew that in their lives, as in mine, there was a certain amount of wreckage, and so they wrote a list of everyone they had ever harmed, and they became willing to make amends to everyone on that list. And they didn't just talk about it, they went out and they did it. You may recall in our literature, it talks about Dr. Bob's first day. He spent his time after work driving around Akron, Ohio in his old Buick. And when he got back late at night, Bill asked him where he'd been, and he said he was out mending fences. It's an old Vermont expression. He was making amends the very first day that he began to stop drinking. And I don't think that we need wait so very long in our program to do all of the things that we are supposed to do. And this is especially true if we understand what the benefits are. And in order for us to understand what the benefits are, they have written in the big book, and I have a little portion of the big book here, and it says that we are painstaking about this phase of our development. We will be amazed before we are halfway through. We will know a new happiness. We will comprehend the word serenity. And we will know peace. We will not regret the past or wish to look down upon it. I have very poor eyesight. Comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience will benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. Self-seeking will leave us. We will gain interest in our fellows. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us all of the things we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. They will always materialize if we work for them. And I'm very happy to report to you that each and every one of those promises has come into my life as a result of this program. And by this time, these were fairly sober people. And the book tells us that they had been restored to sanity. And they knew that they had been given something that was very, very precious. And so they resolved that they would maintain it. And in order to maintain it, they continued to take personal inventory. They knew they could not enjoy the luxury of a resentment. They knew they could not be hateful or resentful. They knew that if they were resentful, they would drink. And if they drank, they would die. It was simple with them. And so, when they were wrong, they promptly admitted that they were wrong. And so great and so true was their reliance upon this power greater than their own, this God of their understanding, that they sought to improve their conscious contact with God. And they did that by prayer and by meditation. They meditated. They gave thought to their condition. They considered who they were and what they were. And they engaged in a very fine, a very excellent form of meditation. It is the form of meditation in which you are now engaged. They listen. They listen. On the odd chance that this power that they had come to believe in would speak to them. And this power that they had come to believe in did speak to them in their groups, at their meetings. And they prayed, brothers, they prayed. And no one needs a sermon from me on the value of prayer. When they prayed only for knowledge of God's will for them and the power to carry that out. I cannot know, however, it was with you, but it always seemed to me, since I was very young, going through school and all, I always had this feeling that I did not belong. I knew I was in the wrong family, I was in the wrong neighborhood, I was in the wrong schools. I knew that. I never did belong to those people. I just didn't belong there. And that feeling persisted, even though the package was moving through the system successfully. I was a successful child. I had a lot of friends, and I was good at everything I ever did. I was good at school, and I had married well, and I lived well, and I did all of these things. But I knew that I didn't belong. And this feeling persisted, and it creates something down around here where there's a big hole, where the wind blows, and it makes the days very long, and it makes the nights very dark. And then I came here, and I learned from you how to pray. And in the 12 and 12 on the chapter on prayer in the last paragraph, and this is not a quotation, but it's close, it says that one of the greatest benefits that comes to us from prayer is the great sense of belonging that it brings to us. We are no longer lost or alone or frightened or purposeless. That despite all of the evidence in the world around us, we understand that the values of life are truth and justice and love, and that we understand that a loving God watches over us, and we know that when we turn to Him, all will be well with us here and hereafter. And I am able to report to you that that sense of belonging has come to me. And now when I tell you that I am Ray O'Keefe, and I am an alcoholic, and a member of the Mamaroneck Group, I'm really telling you who I am, and what I am, and where I belong. It isn't so much that I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I belong to Alcoholics Anonymous. It isn't so much that I am a member of that group. I belong to that group. And this is a very, very good feeling, and it's been in my life for a long time. And I meditate and think about it all the time, and it makes me feel like I belong. And I have felt that way since ever I have been with you on this weekend. I do not patronize you when I say that I belong here. This is exactly where I am supposed to be at this minute. I consider it a great privilege to be here during the Easter time. A little later, these men and women came upon another prayer that they thought might help, and so they appropriated it. And this time, they prayed for themselves, and the only thing they asked was peace of mind. And so they prayed that God would grant them the serenity to accept the things they could not change. And they did change. Something happened to these men and women. There was a great difference in their life. There was a great difference between being drunk and being sober, there was a great conversion of their values and a great substitution of their standards. And they termed this difference between being drunk and being sober a spiritual awakening. And they had this spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And these were the men and the women who at the beginning of this process had admitted that they were hopeless and helpless and powerless. These were the ones who had no power. But having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, they found that they held in their hands and in their heart and in our program one of the greatest forces of spiritual power that the world has ever seen. They actually had the power to arrest the disease of alcoholism. They actually had the power to save life. And the only thing they were using was the great power of example of one drunk for another. And armed with that power and having had that kind of a spiritual awakening, they began to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffered. And they did that so well that you and I have come together on a night in April in 1984 in the very beautiful city of San Diego in the great state of California. And that, my dear, dear sisters and brothers, is a long, long way from Akron, Ohio. And they knew. They knew what my sponsor knew. They knew what he knew when he told me that there was a great deal more to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous than merely its being a device to keep me from drinking like a pig. They knew what he knew. They knew what my good friends, Nancy and Mert, know, that what has been given to us is an entirely new way of living. And in order to enjoy that new way of living, they resolved that they would practice principles in all their affairs. And so, where they had been, as I always was, very arrogant, they tried not to be so arrogant. Where they had been, as I always was, very dishonest, they tried not to be so dishonest. Fortunately for me, and perhaps for us all, they said we need not be saints. They said it was not a program of spiritual perfection. They said it was a program of spiritual progress. And my sponsor has instructed me, and so I believe, that I can progress in the program if I don't drink and go to the meetings. I could keep you for a long, long time just to tell you of all of the truly wonderful and marvelous things that have happened to me since ever I became sober. But I would not keep you that long. If you have a good wish for me, And I am sure that you do. Please be assured that anything at all that you might wish for me has already happened in my life. Wholly, solely, and simply because I am a member of this fellowship. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has returned back to me everything that the disease of alcoholism took from me. Every position, every honor, every title, every dollar have all been returned to me in ways that I could never explain. And it is all simply because I am a member of this fellowship. I have been and I am now a professor of law. And in 1983, after a simple 20-year sabbatical, I was reappointed by the same school that had discharged me. And in 1984, I quit. I told him I wasn't to be pushed around like that. And I quit to take a better and a more full-time teaching position, which I will start in August in the state of Florida. And this is just some of the stuff that's been going on with me. More importantly, and I'm sure you will understand and appreciate how the O'Keefes are, when I tell you that I'm able to bring to you the warm and the fraternal greetings of five of my children who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if that's a record, but we have a lot of distance there. I would truly be remiss if I did not thank whoever it was on the committee who had the extreme good judgment to bring me to San Diego. I have forgiven the city for arresting me. I have forgiven the Coronado Hotel for throwing me out that night. I truly do not want to patronize you at all, and even to remind you of the beauty of your city and the wonderfulness of your climate and the warmth of your reception. I will remember this weekend for a long, long time. I am one of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I suppose you suspect that I travel the country a great deal. And everywhere I go, I say just about the same thing. And every time I end, I say exactly the same thing. I remind you of a pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous, which has been very dear to me, called A Member's View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that pamphlet, at the end of it, the author takes a biblical turn. And he reminds us of the time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin Jesus as to whether he was the Messiah. And these two men walked with the Lord a while, and one day they stopped him and they said to him, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one that we have been waiting for? Or should we wait for another?" And the Lord really didn't answer that question. But he said to these two men, "Go back to John and tell John only what you have seen and only what you have heard. Tell John that the blind see. And tell John that the lame walk and the deaf can hear. and tell John that the sick are made well, and that the poor have the gospel brought to them. In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And everyone knows that the word gospel simply means good news. And so, my dear, dear sisters and brothers, here at San Diego in Happy Conference Assembled, if you will accept a report from me based upon my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will tell you only what I have seen and only what I have heard. And based upon that observation, it seems to me that the blind do see, and the lame do walk. And I know that the deaf can hear. And most certainly, the sick are made well. And I have seen over and over and over again, through the longest day and into the darkest night, the good news of our program brought to the alcoholic who still suffers, the poor in spirit. Thank you.